For marine mammals, this is unprecedented injury, unprecedented spill, unprecedented restoration approach. And so it's not like we have a lot of history to build upon, unlike some of the other resource categories. So for the Gulf of Mexico cetacean species, there are 20 species offshore. There's 22 species total. 21 of those are cetaceans, and a lot of stocks. And under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, we manage by stock. As we think about monitoring and effective monitoring tools, we have to break that up into kind of habitat areas. And so we break it up into bay, sound, and estuaries, and coastal, so kind of the coastal areas, the continental shelf and the species that reside there, and then the deep water or oceanic waters. And multiple species sit in there. The coastal and the bay, sound, and estuaries for cetaceans is all bottlenose dolphins by different stocks. Most of this presentation, almost all of this presentation, is about cetaceans, not manatees, but many of the things can go across the different taxa. So when we look at assessments and the tools that we used in the injury assessment, which has become the baseline of status of what's going on for health and population in the Northern Gulf. For oceanic species, we did research cruises looking at distribution, exposure, demographics, prey, remote biopsies, tagging, and passive acoustic monitoring. For the coastal species, aerial surveys, prey availability, and again, remote biopsies. And then for the bay, sound, and estuaries and bottlenose dolphins, that's a key indicator species because we can do a lot of work with them and gain a lot of information above and beyond just abundance and distribution. We did longitudinal photo ID surveys, and that started 10 days after the spill began in certain key sites. Remote biopsies, again, early May of 2010. Capture-release health assessments and straining investigation that continued from the day the spill began until it is continuing now. And so for the bay, sound, and estuaries and the bottlenose dolphin populations, which became our key study species to understand impacts, we did both live and dead work, and that was a real bonus to our ability to detect injury due to the spill. And because we had a long-standing stranding network, and we've done over the last 20 years a lot of dolphin health assessments, we had significant data collected to develop reference ranges and reference populations to compare to. So the primary focus was Barataria Bay, Louisiana, a heavily oiled area, and then we looked at Mississippi Sound as another focus area. Our major reference site was Sarasota Bay, in which they've had a 35-year-long study population for comparison. And then for strandings, we used Texas, west coast of Florida, and South Carolina as reference populations. Looking at what we did throughout the evaluation, on the right-hand side are the observational studies and the remote biopsy sampling, and the list below gives you an idea of the types of things that can be gained by that work. The observational studies and remote biopsies started in May of 2010 and ended in 2014. The stranding dolphins and dead dolphin tissue evaluations, that gives you an idea of the types of information that can be gained from that. And that began in April 30th, 2010, but it was an ongoing project prior to that and is currently still, data is still being collected for the programmatic DARP. It ended in June of 2015. And then the live animal health assessments, and that means capturing an animal and doing complete physical exams like you would get if you went to the hospital or into the doctor's office. It's blood panels, ultrasound, pregnancy assessment, and pregnancy assessment through ultrasound allows you to determine gestational age and predict calving and do reproductive follow-up to look at calving success from that. And then a lot of other things are evaluated. One of the main rule-outs we had for mortality and serious injury and the poor health that we found were infectious agents and biotoxins, and we were able to get information on that from both the live animal and the dead animal. So the key findings in Barataria Bay was poor health, and we had several parameters, but two of clinical importance. One was adrenal gland function, which is critical for survival, and the other is lung function. And for cetaceans, their lungs are very different than ours. They exchange 90% of their lung volume per breath compared to 20 to 30% for us. They don't have nasal cavities to clear air or toxins. It goes directly into the lungs, and they dive to depth or hold their breath underwater, and in some offshore species, including 90 minutes to 120 minutes underwater, breath hold diving and collapse of the alveoli. They also have double capillary beds around the alveoli, so they increase uptake, and the rapidity between uptake and movement across that barrier is critically important. Diving and healthy lungs are important for body condition, survivorship, getting away from predators, and feeding in cetaceans. So looking at the evidence we have from the live animals, we have hypoadrenocorticism as measured by a reaction to a stressor and cortisol. And the yellow or orange is Barataria Bay, and the green is our reference population. And then in the dead animals, we had morphological evidence of adrenal injury. For lung disease, it's severe lung disease based on the live animal assessments using ultrasound, and the dead animals looking at primary prevalence of primary bacterial pneumonia. For increased mortality, we looked at survivorship using the photo ID mark recapture, and the survival rate for Barataria Bay is 80 to 85% of the live animals in the bay, and Sarasota Bay it's 96, and Charleston Estuary 95, and those were our reference populations. For the dead animals, we had a significant increase in mortality immediately shortly after the spill, lasting through 2011, and it was unprecedented in mortality in central Louisiana over history. And then we had evidence of impaired reproduction. And the impaired reproduction is looking at survivorship from known pregnancies, whether there's observed with a live calf and does the calf survive, again, using the observational studies and the biopsies. And Barataria Bay and Mississippi Sound had 19% reproductive success and lasted over multiple years. We know reproduction for some known individual females, multiple reproduction cycles, so multiple years of failed pregnancy. For Sarasota Bay, 83% success rate, and the combined baseline across multiple sites is 65%. So comparing 19% success to 65%. In the dead animals, we know that the animals high mortality of perinates, so animals shortly before, shortly after birth, with most died in utero. Most had fetal distress, and the prevalence of Brucella, which is a known cause of third trimester abortions in cetaceans, was not that different from reference populations. So it wasn't, for Barataria Bay, driven by brucellosis. So in looking at quantification, quantifying the impacts to stocks, we recognize that cetaceans are long-lived. They're slow maturing, and they're case-selected species. It's difficult to recover from the loss of reproductive adults, and just counting dead individuals does not fully describe the impact to stock. These species give birth to one calf every 1 to 3 to 5 years, depending on the species. And that is due to nutritional dependence and social dependence that they have for raising the calves to reproductive adults. Injuries were quantified using a population model that allows for consideration of long-term impacts to the population and resulting from individual losses, and allows for incorporation of reproductive effects that are going to slow recovery. in how we go forward. So I'll say right up front to Eric, I'm not a statistician nor a modeler. So if you have questions on statistics or modeling, we'll take them back and get answers back to you. I'm a wildlife veterinarian with a PhD in toxicology. So looking at the way that we are moved forward with quantification is we use Barataria Bay and Mississippi Sound to develop our initial injury in those two areas. And feeding into that were spatial robust capture recapture models and reproductive outcomes models using the remote biopsy and the health assessment and photo ID. So we did a lot of follow-up work looking at known individuals and looking at reproductive success. And from that, we did an age, sex, and class-structured population model. In addition, in order to feed into that, we looked at initial BSC population sizes, and you can see what went into that, a lot of additional modeling. We looked at initial coastal population sizes, and then we did some baseline population dynamics based on the literature and some other studies. In order to extrapolate to the other BSC and coastal populations, and BSC is Bay, Sound, and Estuary population. Sorry for using the shortcut. We looked at stranding recovery and stranding rates and different stocks. So we used a lot of genetics and stable isotopes to assign each carcass to a stock, and then looked at the excess carcasses attributed to the spill, and then that fed into the model for extrapolation to the other areas. So the metrics that came out of this are years to recovery, lost cetacean years, and maximum proportional decrease. And I'll talk about that in a minute. So for Barataria Bay, the spill caused 35% excess mortality, 46% excess failed pregnancy over the time period studied, and 37% higher likelihood that animals would have adverse health effects. And adverse health effects affects survival and your survivorship over time. So to put this into kind of a model output, we looked at the top line. The black line is what the population would have been but for the spill. The red line goes through what the population model output shows happened during the spill, and then modeling the years to recovery up to 150 years. The dotted line is the largest proportional decrease in the population size, and then that's quantified by stock in the PowerPoint that I'm going to show you in a minute. The lost cetacean years is the shaded red, and then the number of years for the population to recover to within 95% of baseline trajectory is the large dashed line that goes across the slide vertically. This is the table that you can't read, but this is we have two tables that are put in for each stock that was assessed and shown as injured. And this first one is lost cetacean years, years to recovery, and maximum reduction in population. And just to give you an idea of years to recovery, went from 10 years for beaked whales to 105 years for spinner dolphins. Maximum reduction, the highest was reduction of 71% in the Mississippi River Delta. So when we talk about long-term recovery for bottlenose dolphin, it extends way beyond the 15 years of the restoration, and we need to be thinking as far as monitoring projects, looking at something that is that long-term. In addition, we provided a quantification table, and this is only a portion of it, that goes to the pre-spill abundance, population exposed by percent, the population killed by percent, the females with reproductive failure by percent, and the population with adverse health effects. There is a very long document, technical report that actually outlines specifically how all of the modeling was done for the quantification, and that is found in the administrative record, not in the PDARP report itself. And if you would like us to extract a copy of that report and send it as a PDF to the committee, we will be happy to do that. And then the restoration goals for marine mammals is an integrated portfolio. You've heard that word a lot. It's to mitigate key stressors to support resilient populations and improve resilient to natural stressors. And so it's trying to increase survivorship, increase reproduction through a variety of different mechanisms, all in the context of the restoration activities that are going on overall and continued development of the Gulf of Mexico. The restoration strategy is to target oceanic, coastal, and bay sound and estuarine stocks in Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and support resilient populations, reduce further harm. If we look at proposed project, this gives you a list of the types of things that are in the PDARP to be proposed enhance the recovery and decrease the years to restore and to decrease the years it will take to recover the populations. And I don't know how I'm doing on time, but okay. So the key monitoring elements are population characterization and health assessments, identification, prioritization, and modeling of stressors on marine mammals, and enhancement and expansion of observer programs and fishery observer programs and marine mammal stranding network programs. The marine mammal stranding network programs, because most stranded animals are bay sound and estuary or coastal bottlenose dolphins, will be really targeted towards that coastal BSC area. We do have large mass stranding events and unusual mortality events that occur for offshore animals, and again, those are a smaller proportion of what we see. The current monitoring for marine mammal stocks under the Marine Mammal Protection Act relies on periodic abundance surveys. Under current survey design, the ability to detect precipitous declines is very low for cetaceans. And even if decline is found, you've already lost a lot of years and a lot of cetaceans, and you have little to no information on the cause of the decline. So looking at ongoing monitoring efforts for marine mammals in the Gulf, most of the efforts that are ongoing now are driven by understanding impacts due to regulatory requirements. So BOEM is undergoing a comprehensive monitoring planning effort for the effects of geophysical survey activity, which will continue in the Gulf. The Navy uses monitoring programs to inform the effects of Navy training exercises, including underwater noise. NIMS does periodic stock assessment surveys, and then the Stranding Network relies on private funding. They are getting some assistance through the Gulf Environmental Benefit Fund, managed by NIFWIF, for Alabama, and I think they currently have some other thoughts of being able to use that to enhance the stranding program, and then Prescott Grant Program and others. What we don't currently have plans for and need to be incorporated in the overall monitoring of marine mammals in the Gulf are some of the things we're talking about here, Restore Act, restoration monitoring, and then it's going to be hugely important for all of the efforts that we look at cumulative impacts. It's not as if the restoration activity is going to happen in a vacuum in a pristine environment. There's still going to be extractions, which was discussed before, but there's still going to be significant development going on. Monitoring for health and population parameters, more so than just abundance, can get us a lot more information and may be more sensitive as a monitoring program to look at either the effectiveness of the restoration activities or the potential impacts and some of the other science needs and environmental compliance. And so this just gives you an idea of the population parameters that could be used and the health parameters that could be used. These don't include some of the new tools and techniques that I'll talk about in a minute that can take some of the depth of studies we've done in the bay sounds and estuarine dolphins to the coastal and the more pelagic populations using a little bit different methods. And indicator species are really important for marine mammals because we have 56 stocks of cetaceans in the Gulf of Mexico, and monitoring any of those intensively is very, very difficult, costly, and probably not practical. And some are not easily monitored. So indicator species are going to be very important to do. We have chosen some for the injury assessment, but we need to think more clearly as to whether we continue those, add more, or shift given where the injuries now have been quantified and the direction that we need to go. The indicators need to be linked to with ecosystem health or representative of other species, and they need to be conducive to the appropriate sampling to address the question you're looking for. And as part of the Deepwater Horizon management of the activities we did so far, we actually developed our own database for the dead animal data and tracking of all samples and the live animal data. That has now been merged into one database that has it is the foundation now for something we call the Gulf of Mexico Marine Mammal Health Monitoring and Analysis Platform. We are moving forward on that monitoring and analysis platform nationwide, but we're focusing on the Gulf because of the significant amount of activities going on in the Gulf. In addition, and that is in coordination with IUS, OBIS, and with NCEI, the National Center for Environmental Information, and has a lot of partners across the academic and the federal and NGO partnerships. In the Gulf of Mexico, there's also the Gulf of Mexico Dolphin Identification System, so that we can look across the bay, sound, and estuary and coastal regions across all the states. And that is being run out of Moat Marine Lab. Stock assessments are done in the Gulf by the Southeast Fisheries Science Center, and most of that data is put out on OBIS. And then the Animal Telemetry Network, there is a lot more marine mammal telemetry operations going on, and that data will be partnered with the IUS effort for the Animal Telemetry Network. I was asked to also address the potential impacts and benefits of restoration activities in the nearshore environment. The nearshore environment will be affecting bottlenose dolphins, and we already know that some of those bottlenose dolphin populations have serious injuries and significant impacts to the population. And so some of the things that we look at are salinity and changes in salinity, because salinity is critically important to bottlenose dolphin health and other cetacean health. They're adapted to a higher salinity environment. Reducing that to freshwater causes serious injury and mortality. The two pictures here are not healthy dolphins. Those dolphins are freshwater disease dolphins, and what happens with them is their skin starts to alter, it becomes permeable, and they start to have physiological responses to that. These show animals with significant, and the one on the bottom is dead, significant injury due to freshwater disease. And it's how low does it go and how long does it last is critical for the health of bottlenose dolphins. Noise is a huge issue for cetaceans because they have to find their prey and find each other using the underwater detection with noise. And so looking at some of the health of the noise set sound mapping project that NOAA is doing, the Gulf of Mexico is one of the noisiest ocean bodies that we have around the coast of the United States. So a reduction of ocean noise or increase of ocean noise would be critically important. Disturbance, and I think there could be benefits of nearshore restoration activities long-term, getting from point A to point B. We have to evaluate the disturbance issue on cetacean populations in that area. And I'm assuming this also goes for turtles and other protected species listed under the Endangered Species Act. And then prey and habitat, increasing the amount of prey and the quality of prey would be really a benefit for bottlenose dolphins. It would increase body condition and also increase reproduction. And decreasing prey and the quality of prey and the type of prey would have a negative benefit. So it depends on what happens on that in the short term, again, long-term impacts. And then direct human interactions, again, some of that is entrapment and entrainment. As levees are changed and water islands are moved and places are closed in for redirection of water, in the past, bottlenose dolphins have been trapped inside and eventually die unless they're rescued and removed. And then pathogens, HABs, and contaminants, alterations, hopefully would be improving with improved water quality and nearshore activities, but also could be significantly negative during the development period. New tools and technology, a lot of things coming down the road on being able to better monitor marine mammals, both abundance distribution, but also some very significant health parameters. And looking at the top right one is drones looking at collection of breath, and the one on the right side looks like somebody holding a pipe over a dolphin's head, and that is a new method for collecting breath that has been developed in work with the Navy and the bottlenose dolphins they have, and has been used in the field, was used in Barataria Bay, and that helps us validate what we find in breath and what we find in the physical exam of the animal. And then that can be extrapolated to doing breath collection in free-swimming mysticetes, baleen whales, and interpreted. And then a lot of the other things are new technologies that will give us a lot more information in those offshore species that we have minimal ability to catch, handle, and do physicals. And that is it. I hope I'm within the time frame, but I'd be happy to answer questions now.